friends, whispered back, "It's aerial yoga." Louder, she said, "Kala, it's about Ronan." Kala readjusted, wrapping the silk around her other thigh instead.
"Which one's he again? The pretty one?"
Blue and Gansey exchanged a look. Blue's look said, "I'm so, so sorry." Gansey said, "Am I the pretty one?" Kala continued turning, almost imperceptibly. It was becoming more obvious as she swiveled that she was not the thinnest woman on the planet, but that she had stomach muscles like, whoa!
"The Coca-Cola shirt?"
She meant Adam. He'd worn a red Coca-Cola shirt to the first reading and was now and forevermore identified by it. Ronan said, his voice a low growl, "The snake." Kala's rotation finished just as he said it. They looked at each other for a long moment, him right side up, her upside down. Chainsaw on Ronan's shoulder twisted her head to get a better look. There was nothing particularly sympathetic about Ronan just then, handsome mouth drawing a cruel line, eerie tattoo creeping out the collar of his black T-shirt, raven pressed against the side of his shaved head. It was hard to remember the Ronan who'd pressed that tiny mouse to his cheek back at the barns. Upside down, Kala was trying to look dismissive, but it was clear that one of her arched eyebrows was terribly interested.
"I see," she replied finally. "What sort of advice do you need, snake?"
"My dreams," Ronan replied. Now Kala's eyebrows matched her dismissive mouth. She allowed herself to circle away from them again.
"Persephone's the one you'll want for dream interpretation. Have a nice life."
"They'll interest you," Ronan said. Kala just cackled and stretched one of her legs out. Blue made an irritated noise. Taking two strides across the room, she pressed the puzzle box to Kala's bare cheek. Kala stopped spinning. Slowly she righted herself. The gesture was as elegant as a ballet move, a swan dancer unfolding. She said,
"Why didn't you say so?"
Ronan said, "I did." Her plum lips pursed.
"Something you should know about me, snake. I don't believe anyone."
Chainsaw hissed. Ronan said, "Something you should know about me. I never lie." Kala continued performing aerial yoga for the entirety of the conversation. Sometimes she was right side up, her legs curved beneath her.
"All of these things are still a part of you. To me, they feel precisely the same as you feel. Well, mostly. They're like your nail clippings. So they all share the same life as you. The same soul. You're the same entity."
Ronan wanted to protest this. If Chainsaw fell off a table, he didn't feel her pain, but he wouldn't feel the pain of one of his nail clippings either.
"So when you die, they'll stop."
"Stop? Not die themselves?" Gansey asked. Kala turned herself upside down, her knees bent and her feet pressed to each other. It made her a cunning spider.
"When you die, your computer doesn't die too. They never really lived like you're thinking of life. It's not a soul that's animating them. Take away the dreamer and they're a computer waiting for input."
Ronan thought of what Declan had said all those months before. "Mom is nothing without Dad." He'd been right. "So my mother is never going to wake up." Kala slid slowly upright, freeing her hands.
"Snake, hand me that bird."
"Don't squeeze," Ronan said narrowly, folding the raven's wings against her body and relinquishing her. Chainsaw promptly bit Kala's finger. Unimpressed, Kala snapped her teeth back at the raven.
"Careful, chickadee," she told Chainsaw, her smile deadly. "I bite too. Blue."
This meant she wanted to use Blue's invisible ability to hone her vision. Blue rested one hand on Kala's knee and used the other to keep Kala from rotating. For a long moment, Kala hung there with her eyes closed.
chainsaw was motionless in her hands, fluffed up over the ignominy of it all. Then Calla fixed her gaze on Ronan, a sharply structured smile manifesting on her plum-painted lips. "What have you done, Snake?" Ronan didn't reply. Silence was never a wrong answer. Calla stuffed the bird into Blue's hands, who tried to placate her before returning her to Ronan. Calla said, "Here's the deal. Your mother was a dream. Your fool father took her out. What, there aren't enough women in the world without making one? And now, she has no dreamer. You want her back, she has to go back in a dream."
She did several elaborate procedures then, all of them elegant and effortless-looking. They reminded Ronan a bit of the movement of the puzzle box, in that they seemed to be a little illogical, a little impossible. It was hard to understand how she extracted an arm from the silk without getting her torso tangled. Difficult to see how she twisted that leg without falling to the floor. Ronan interrupted the silence.
"Cabeswater. Cabeswater is a dream."
Calla stopped rotating.
"You don't have to tell me I'm right," Ronan said. He thought of all the times he had dreamt of Cabeswater's old trees. How familiar it had felt to walk there. How the trees had known his name. He was tangled in their roots somehow, and they in his veins. "If Mom is in Cabeswater, she'll wake up."
Calla stared at him. Silence was never a wrong answer. Gazi said, "I guess we really do have to get Cabeswater back then." Blue tilted her head so that Calla was slightly less upside down to her. "Any ideas?"
"I'm not a magician," Calla said.
Blue gave her a spin. Calla laughed all the way around, a filthy, pleased sound. She pointed to Ronan as he headed out the door.
"But he is. Also, get rid of that mask. It's a nasty bit of work."
22. Last Will and Testament of Neil T. Lynch, Article 1, Preliminary Declarations. I am married to Aurora Lynch, and all references in this will to my spouse refer to Aurora Lynch. I have 3 living children named Declan T. Lynch, Ronan N. Lynch, and Matthew A. Lynch. All references in this will to my child or children or issue include the above child or children and any child or children hereafter born to or adopted by me. All references to middle son refer to Ronan N. Lynch.
I was thinking we could all get together for the 4th of July, Matthew said, peering up at Ronan. The late evening light made his curls cherubic. At Ronan's request, they'd met for dinner at the downtown Park Square. It was a selfish act. Both Declan and Ronan treated Matthew as their security blanket. "The 3 of us. For fireworks." Ronan hunched above him on the edge of the battered picnic table.
"No."
Before his younger brother had a chance to say something to unintentionally guilt him into it, Ronan gestured to Matthew's paper-wrapped tuna fish sandwich with his own.
"How's your sandwich?"
"Oh, it's good,"
Matthew said enthusiastically. It was not much of an endorsement. Matthew Lynch was a golden, indiscriminate pit into which the world threw food. "It's real good. I couldn't believe when you called. When I saw your phone number, I nearly shit myself. You could sell your phone, like, as new in box."
"Don't fucking swear," Ronan said.
Article 2. Specific Bequests and Devices. I give the sum of $23 million to a separate trust which shall provide for the perpetual care and maintenance of the property referred to as the Barns, see Item B, and for the care, education, and housing of my surviving children. This trust shall be executed by Declan T. Lynch until all children have reached the age of 18. I give the sum of $3 million To my son, Declan T. Lynch, once he has reached the age of 18. I give the sum of $3 million to my son, Ronan N. Lynch, once he has reached the age of 18. I give the sum of $3 million to my son, Matthew A. Lynch, once he has reached the age of 18. Ronan took one of Matthew's potato chips and gave it to Chainsaw, who mutilated it on the table's surface more for the sound than the taste. On the sidewalk, a lady pushing a baby carriage gave him a dirty look for either sitting on top of the table or for looking disreputable while trafficking with carrion birds. Ronan reflected her look back at her after adding a few more degrees of shittiness to it. Look, does Declan still have his panties in a twist over us going back to the barns? Matthew, chewing fondly, waved at the contents of the baby carriage. The contents waved back. He spoke through his mouthful. They always are. His panties, I mean. Twisted. Over it. And you. Is it true we'll lose our money if we go back? Was Dad really as bad as Declan says? Article 7. Further condition. Upon my death, none of my children shall trespass the physical boundaries of the barns, nor disturb any of the contents there, living or inert, or the assets dealt within this will shall be bequeathed instead to the New York Roscommon Fund, apart from the trust established for Aurora Lynch's continued care. What? Ronan put his sandwich down. Chainsaw angled in. What does he say about Dad? His younger brother shrugged. I don't know, just he was never there or something. You know. Hey, Declan's not that bad. I don't know why you guys can't get along. Mommy and Daddy just don't love each other anymore, Ronan thought, but he couldn't say it to Matthew, who gazed up at him with the same trusting eyes the baby mouse had turned on him. This dinner wasn't enough to restore his balance. His illicit visit to the barns, his realization about his mother, and Calla's assessment of the situation had badly shaken him. Suddenly he was presented with a decision, whether or not to revive their mother. If he could have his mother back, that would help, surely, even if she had to live in Caveswater. One parent was better than no parents. Life was better than death. Awake was better than asleep. But those words of Declan's needled Ronan. She's nothing without Dad. It was like he knew. Ronan wanted badly to know how much Declan knew, but it wasn't like he could ask him. Declan started hating me first, Ronan said, in case you were wondering, so that wasn't me. Matthew blew out a tuna-scented breath with the sanguine, pleasant air of either a nun or a pothead. He was just upset Dad liked you the best. I didn't care. Everybody has favorite things. Mom liked me best, anyway. Article 2A. Further bequests. I give my entire interest in the real property which was my residence at the time of my death, the barns, together with any insurance on such property, to my middle son. They both quietly ate their sandwiches. Ronan thought they were probably both considering how this left Declan as no one's favorite. If I was your favorite, he asked his dead father, why did you leave me a home I could never return to? Carefully. This was difficult because Ronan never did anything carefully. He asked, does Declan ever talk about dreams? He had to repeat the question. Both Matthew and Chainsaw had gotten distracted by a circling pair of monarch butterflies. Like his? Matthew asked. He shrugged elaborately. I don't think he dreams. He takes sleeping pills, did you know? Ronan didn't know. What kind? I don't know. I looked at the bottle, though. Doc Mack gave them to him. Doc the fuck who? The Aglinby doctor? Ronan hissed. He's not a doctor, man. He's a nurse practitioner or something. I don't think he's legal to give out drugs. Why does Declan take sleeping pills?
Matthew stuffed the remaining quarter of his sandwich in his mouth. Says you're giving him an ulcer.
Ulcers are not sleeping problems. They are when acid eats a fucking hole through your stomach.
Says you and Dad were both dreamers, Matthew said, and you're going to make us lose everything.
Ronan sat very still. He was so still so quickly that Chainsaw froze as well, her head tilted toward the youngest Lynch brother, purloined tuna sandwich forgotten. Declan knew about their father. Declan knew about their mother. Declan knew about him. What did it change? Nothing, maybe.
He put a gun under the seat of his car, Matthew said. I saw it when my phone fell down between the seats.
Ronan realized that Matthew had stopped chewing and moving and was instead just curved on the bench of the picnic table, his liquid eyes uncertain on his older brothers.
Don't say burglars, Matthew said finally.
I wasn't going to, Ronan replied. You know I don't lie. Matthew nodded fast. He was biting his lip. His eyes were unselfconsciously damp.
Look, Ronan said, and then again.
Look, I think I know how to fix Mom. She won't be able to stay at the barns and, I mean, we can't go there anyway. I think I know how to fix her, so at least we'll have her.
Neil Lynch was, at the time of so executing said will, of sound mind, memory, and understanding, and not under any restraint or in any respect incompetent to make a will. This will stands as fact unless a newer document is created. Signed this day, T. Libra, Ve Roabar, Nivo, Libre, Nacre.
This was probably why he'd called Matthew. Probably he'd meant to promise this impossible hope from the very beginning. Probably he needed to say it out loud so it would stop chewing a fucking hole through his stomach. His younger brother looked wary.
Really?
The decision galvanized Ronan. I promise.
23. It took the gray man several days to realize he had lost his wallet. He would have noticed it sooner if he hadn't been overcome by gray days. Days where morning seemed bled of color and getting up unimportant. The gray man often didn't eat during them. He certainly didn't keep track of time. He was at once sleeping and awake, both of them the same, dreamless, listless. And then one morning he would open his eyes and find the sky had become blue again. He had several gray days in the basement of Pleasant Valley Bed and Breakfast, and after he'd roused himself at dawn and shakily eaten something, he reached into the back pocket of his pants and found it empty. His fake ID and useless credit cards, the gray man paid for everything in cash, all gone. It must be at 300 Fox Way. He'd try to swing back there later. He checked his phone for messages from Greenmantle, let his eyes skip unseeingly over his brother's missed call from days before, and finally consulted his jotted, coded notes to himself. He glanced out the window. The sky was an unreal shade of blue. He always felt so alive that first day. Humming a bit, the gray man pocketed his keys. Next up, Monmouth Manufacturing. Gansey hadn't been doing well with Cabe's Water's disappearance. He'd tried to come to grips with it. This was just another setback, and he knew he needed to treat it like every other setback, make a new plan, find another lead, throw all the resources in a new direction, but it didn't feel like any other setback. He had spent 48 hours more or less awake and restless, and then, on the third day, he had bought a side-scan sonar device, two window air conditioners, a leather sofa, and a pool table.
Now do you feel better? Adam had asked dryly.
Gansey had replied, I have no idea what you're talking about.
Hey, man, Ronan said. I like the pool table. The entire situation made Blue apoplectic.
There are children starving in the streets of Chicago, she said, her hair bristling with indignation. Three species go extinct every hour because there's no funding to protect them. You are still wearing those incredibly stupid boat shoes, and of all the things that you have bought, you still haven't replaced them.
Gansey, bewildered, observed his feet. The movement of his toes was barely visible through the tops of his topsiders. Really, in light of recent events, these shoes were the only things that were right in the world. I like these shoes.
Sometimes I hate you, Blue said. And Orla, of all people.
This was because Gansey had also rented a boat, a trailer, and a truck to pull it with, and then asked Blue's older cousin Orla to accompany them on their latest trip. The rental truck required a driver over 21, and the mission, according to Gansey, required a psychic. Orla fit both purposes and was more than willing. She had arrived at Monmouth dressed for work, bell-bottoms, platform sandals, and an orange bikini top. There were acres of bare skin between the bell-bottoms and the bikini top. Her bare stomach was so clearly an invitation for admiration that Gansey could hear the dismissive voice of his father in his ear, "Girls these days." But Gansey had seen photos of girls in his father's days, and they didn't look that different to him. He exchanged a glance with Adam, because it had to be done, and of course Blue intercepted it. Her eyes narrowed. She wore two shredded tank tops and a pair of bleached cargo pants. In some parallel universe, there was a Gansey who could tell Blue that he found the 10 inches of her bare calves far more tantalizing than the 13 cubic feet of bare skin Orla sported. But in this universe, that was Adam's job. He was in a terrible mood. Somewhere across Henrietta, something crackled explosively. It was either a transformer falling prey to the electric whims of the ley line or Joseph Kavinsky having premature fun with one of his infamous 4th of July explosives. Either way, it was a good day to get out of town.
We should get moving, Gansey ordered. It's only going to get hotter.
Just a few dozen yards away, the gray man sat in the Champagne Monster on Monmouth Avenue, paging through a history book and listening to Muswell Hillbillies while the air conditioning played across his skin. Really, he should have been reading up on Welsh history. His cursory research on the Lynch brothers revealed that one of the boys they ran with was obsessed with it, but instead he indulged himself by trying his hand at a new translation of Beattie's Death Song. It was like an archaic crossword puzzle.
When the text said, Fole Thayam, Nied Fairai, Nanig Huir,
would it be truer to the original intent of the writer to translate it as, Before the Fated Journey There, or Facing the Path to Death? Pleasurable trials. The gray man looked up as a boy emerged from Monmouth Manufacturing. The overgrown lot was already a mess of teens and rental vehicles and boats. They were clearly getting ready to go somewhere. The boy who had just exited was the square, showy one who looked like he was about to fall into the Senate, Richard Gansey, the third. That meant that somewhere there were at least two more Richard Ganseys. He didn't notice the gray man's rental car parallel parked in the shadows, nor did he notice the white Mitsubishi parked just down the road. The gray man wasn't the only one waiting for the Monmouth Manufacturing building to be vacated. A fellow academic had once asked the gray man, why Anglo-Saxon history? At the time, it had struck the gray man as a foolish and unanswerable question. The things that drew him to that time period were surely unconscious and many-headed, diffused through his blood from a lifetime of influences. One might as easily ask him why he preferred to wear gray, why he disliked gravy of all sorts, why he loved the 70s, why he was so fascinated by brothers when he couldn't seem to succeed at being one himself.
He told the academic that guns had made history boring, which he knew was a lie even as he said it, and then he'd extricated himself from the conversation. Of course, he thought of the true answer later, but it was too late then. It was this. Alfred the Great. Alfred became king during one of the armpits of English history. There was no England, really, not back then. Just small kingdoms with bad teeth and abbreviated tempers. Life was, as the old saying went, nasty, brutish, short. When the Vikings came tearing onto the island, the kingdoms didn't stand a chance. But Alfred stepped in to unite them. He made them a brotherhood, pushed out the Vikings. He'd promoted literacy and the translation of important books, encouraged the poets and the artists and writers. He'd ushered in a renaissance before the Italians had ever considered the concept. He was one man, but he'd changed Anglo-Saxon England forever. He imposed order and honor, and under that crushed-down grass of principle, the flower of poetry and civility had burst through. What a hero, the gray man thought. Another Arthur. His attention snapped up as Ronan Lynch stepped out of the old factory. He was clearly related to Declan. Same nose, same dark eyebrows, same phenomenal teeth. But there was a carefully cultivated sense of danger to this Lynch brother. This was not a rattlesnake hidden in the grass, but a deadly coral snake striped with warning colors. Everything about him was a warning. If this snake bit you, you had no one to blame but yourself. Ronan opened the driver's side door of the charcoal BMW hard enough that the car shook. Then he threw himself in hard enough that the car kept shaking. And then he slammed the door hard enough that the car shook yet more. And then he left with enough speed to make the tires squeal. "Hmm," said the gray man, already preferring this Lynch brother to the last. The rental truck pulled out with rather more care than the BMW had and headed down the street in the same direction. Then, although the lot was empty, the gray man waited. Sure enough, the white Mitsubishi he'd spotted before pulled in, the bass from its stereo slowly liquefying the pavement beneath it. A kid climbed out, carrying a plastic baggie full of something like business cards. He was the sort the gray man preferred to steer clear of. He hummed with a restless, unpredictable energy. The gray man didn't mind dangerous people, but he preferred sober dangerous people. He watched the kid enter the factory and return with only an empty bag. The Mitsubishi tore off, tires squalling. Now the gray man turned off the kinks, walked across the street, and climbed the stairs to the second floor apartment. On the landing, he discovered the contents of Mitsubishi boy's bag, a pile of identical Virginia driver's licenses. Each featured a sullen photograph of Ronan Lynch beside a birth date that would have had him a few months away from celebrating his 75th birthday. Aside from the clearly facetious birth date, they were very good forgeries. The gray man held one up to the light coming through the broken window. Its maker had done a tidy job of replicating the most difficult part, the hologram. The gray man was impressed. He left the licenses lying outside the door and broke into Monmouth Manufacturing. He was careful about it. One could easily break a lock. One could not easily unbreak it. As he picked the lock, he dialed his phone and propped it on his shoulder. It only took a moment for someone to pick up. "Oh, it's you," Mora Sargent said. "King of Swords." "And it's you. The sword in my spine. I seem to have lost my wallet somewhere." The gray man let the compromised door fall open. A smell of musty paper and mint rolled around him. Dust motes played over 1,000 books. This wasn't quite what he'd expected. "When you were vacuuming under Calla, did you happen to see anything?"
"Vacuuming?" Mora said. "I'll look." "Oh, look at that. There is a wallet in the couch. I'll imagine you'll want to pick it up. How's work?"
"I'd love to chat about it." The gray man turned the lock behind himself. If the boys came back for something, he'd have a few seconds to make a plan of action.
face to face.
You're quite creepy.
I imagine you like creepy men.
Probably true,
Mora admitted. Mysterious, possibly. Creepy is a very strong word.
The gray man moved among the cluttered parts of Gansey's quest. He pulled down a map rolled on the wall. He wasn't sure what he was looking for yet.
You could give me a reading.
He smiled faintly as he said it, paging through a book on medieval weaponry that he also owned.
Mora heard the smile in his voice.
I most certainly cannot. Neither of us want that, I can promise.
Are you sure? I could read you more poetry when you're done.
I know a lot of poetry.
Mora clucked. That's Callow's thing.
And what is your thing?
The gray man poked at a stack of books on the Welsh language.
He was so very charmed by all of these things of Richard Gansey's. He wasn't sure, though, that Gansey understood just how well Glendower would be hidden. History was always buried deep, even when you know where to look, and it was hard to excavate it without damaging it. Brushes and cotton swabs, not chisels and pickaxes. Slow work. You had to like doing it.
My thing, Mora said, is that I never tell my thing.
But she was pleased. He could hear it in her voice. He liked her voice, too. She had just enough Henrietta accent so you knew where she came from.
Do I get 3 tries to guess it?
She didn't immediately answer, and he didn't press her. Heart wounds, he knew, made one think more slowly. While he waited, the gray man stooped to study Gansey's miniature model of Henrietta. Such affection in these tiny recreated streets. He straightened, careful not to harm any of the fond buildings, and headed for one of the 2 small bedrooms. Ronan Lynch's room looked as if a bar fight had taken place within its walls. Every surface was covered with expensive bits of expensive speakers and pointy bits of pointy cages and stylishly distressed bits of stylishly distressed jeans.
Tell me this then, Mr. Gray. Are you dangerous?
To some people.
I have a daughter.
Oh, I'm not dangerous to her.
The gray man picked up a box cutter from the desk and studied it. It had been used to wound something before being hastily cleaned.
Mora said, I just don't know if this is a good idea.
Don't you? He inverted a cowboy boot that seemed out of place. He gave it a shake, but nothing fell out. He couldn't say whether the gray Warren was anywhere in the building.
Looking for something without a single description. He had to imagine what a loaf of bread looked like based upon the trail of crumbs it left behind.
I just... Tell me something true about you.
I own a pair of bell-bottoms, he confessed. And an orange disco shirt.
I don't believe you.
You must wear it, then, next time I see you. I couldn't, the gray man said, amused. I'd have to change my name to Mr. Orange.
Personally, Mora replied, I don't think your sense of self should be flexible, especially not if you're going to go around as the King of Swords.
From the main room, the doorknob clicked audibly as the lock was tested. Someone was here. Someone without a key. He told Mora, hold that thought. I have to go.
To kill someone?
Preferably not. The gray man said in a much lower voice. He ducked behind Ronan's half-open door. There are nearly always easier ways.
Mr. Gray!
Someone kicked open the door. The gray man's careful lock work was rendered irrelevant. I will, the gray man interrupted softly. Call you back. Standing in the shadows of Ronan Lynch's room, he watched 2 men stalk in. One man wore an oversized polo shirt, and the other wore a t-shirt printed with a missile. The 2 men took in the scope of the space with obvious annoyance, and then they spread out. The oversized polo shirt clung to the area near the windows to keep watch out in the parking lot, and the other crashed through the boys' belongings. They kicked over stacks of books and pulled out desk drawers and upended the bare mattress. At one point, missile turned to polo shirt.
Missile Shirt held a pair of sunglasses up for inspection.
Gucci, rich bastards.
He dropped the sunglasses before stepping on them. One of the fractured earpieces skidded across the wide floorboards. It made it all the way to the gray man's feet, but only the gray man was watching it. He leaned and picked up the shard, pensively thumbing the sharp, broken end. So these were the people Greenmantle had warned him about, fellow seekers of the Grey Warren, whatever it might be. The gray man picked his teeth with the broken edge of the sunglasses and then used his phone to take photos of the men for Greenmantle. Something about them was making him lose patience. Perhaps it was that they still hadn't noticed that he was watching them. Or perhaps it was the inefficiency of their process. Whatever it was, it solidified precisely as they began to trundle through the miniature model of Henrietta. He didn't know what the Grey Warren looked like, but he was certain that he could find it without kicking in the front of a miniature cardboard courthouse. He swiftly moved out of Ronan's room. "Whoa!" said Missile from the middle of the destroyed Henrietta. "Don't move!" By way of reply, the gray man stuck the sharp end of the earpiece into Polo Shirt's neck. They fought briefly. The gray man used a combination of physics and the edge of the window air conditioner to gently lay the other man down on the floor. It happened so quickly that Missile had only just reached them when the gray man wiped his hands on his slacks and stepped over the body.
"Jesus F. Christ," said Missile. He pointed a knife at the gray man.
This fight lasted slightly longer than the first. It was not that Missile was bad. It was that the gray man was better. And once the gray man had relieved the other man of his knife, it was over immediately. Missile crouched in the wreckage of Henrietta, fingers braced on the floorboards, gasping for breath. "Why are you here?" the gray man asked him. He rested the tip of the knife as far into the man's ear as it would go without making a mess. The man was already trembling, and unlike Declan Lynch, he folded at once.
"Looking for an antique for an employer."
"Who is?" the gray man prompted.
"We didn't get his name. He's French."
The gray man licked his lips. He wondered if Maura Sargent's thing was environmental issues. She hadn't been wearing shoes, and that, to him, possibly was the sort of thing that someone interested in the environment might do. "French living in France or French living over here?"
"I don't know, man. What does it matter? He's got an accent."
It would have mattered to the gray man. It occurred to him that he was going to have to change clothing before he went to 300 Fox Way for his wallet. He had intestinal matter on his slacks. "Do you have a contact number?" "Of course you do not. What was this antique?"
A box. He said it was probably a box. Called the Grey Warren. That we'd know it when we saw it."
The gray man doubted that highly. He looked at his watch. It was nearly 11. The day was racing by and he had so many plans. He said, "Do I kill you or let you go?"
"Please!"
The gray man shook his head. It was a rhetorical question.
24.
"Would you like to explain now why we're in the middle of this puddle?" Adam asked.
"Godforsaken puddle,"
Ronan corrected from beside Gansey. As a pale-skinned, dark-haired, Celtic sort, he didn't care for the heat. The five of them, plus Chainsaw, minus Noah, he had been present but feebly when they'd left, floated in the boat in the middle of the belligerently ugly man-made lake they had found before. It was relentlessly sunny. The smell of the field, warm dirt, reminded Gansey of all the mornings he'd picked up Adam from his parents' double-wide. From shore, crows hollered apocalyptically at them. Chainsaw hollered back. It really was some of the worst Henrietta had to offer. "We're looking under it," Gansey eyed his laptop. He couldn't get the sonar device to communicate with it despite a cursory examination of the instructional manual. Vexation was beginning to bead at his temples and on the back of his neck. Blue, perched at the other end of the boat, asked, "Are we going to sonar every lake on the ley line, or just the ones that piss you off?"
She was still angry about the couch and the pool table and Orla's bare midriff. Orla, tanning idly, wasn't helping. She took up most of the boat, her legs trailing up one side of it and her long bronze torso draped up the other. Every so often she opened her eyes to smile widely at one of the boys, twisting herself this way and that as if she were merely readjusting her spine. "This is a pilot mission," said Gansey. He was more profoundly uncomfortable with Blue being angry at him than he cared to admit to anyone, least of all himself. "Odds suggest that Glendower is not under this lake, but I want to have recourse should we find a body of water we suspect he's under."
"Recourse," echoed Ronan, but without real force.
The water reflected the sun at his face from beneath, rendering him a translucent and fretful god.
"Shit, damn, it's hot!"
Gansey's explanation was not precisely true. He occasionally had hunches, always about finding things, always about Glendower. They were a result of poring over maps and sorting through historical records and recalling the historical finds he'd made before. When you'd found impossible things before, it made the location of another impossible thing more predictable. The hunch about this lake had something to do with this wide field looking like one of the only easy passes through this section of challenging mountains. Something to do with the name of the tiny lane at the bottom of the hill, Hanmer Road. Hanmer being the last name of Glendower's wife. Something to do with where it sat on the line, the look of the field, the prickling of stop and look closer.
"Is it possible that you've bought a $6,500 piece of junk?" Ronan pulled a cord out of the back of the laptop and hooked it up in a different way.
The laptop pretended it couldn't tell the difference. Gansey hit some keys. The laptop pretended he hadn't. The entire process had looked a lot more straightforward on the instructional video online. From the deck of the boat, Orla said,
"I'm having a psychic moment. It involves you and me."
Distracted, Gansey glanced up from the computer screen.
"Were you talking to me or Ronan?"
"Either.
I'm flexible."
Blue made a small, terrible noise.
"I would appreciate if you'd turn your inner eye toward the water," Gansey said, "because..."
God damn it, Ronan, that made the screen go black. He was beginning to think he had bought a $6,500 piece of junk. He hoped the pool table worked better.
"How long are we in D.C. for?"
Adam asked suddenly. Gansey said, "3 days." Thank goodness Adam had agreed to go. There was plenty of opportunity to be had at a fundraiser like this one. Internships, future positions, sponsors. An impressive-sounding name on the bottom of a college recommendation letter. So many pearls to be had, if you were in the mood to open oysters. Gansey so hated oysters.
Ronan aggressively jerked a cable on the back of the laptop. The sonar device appeared on the laptop screen, shaped like a tiny submarine.
"You brilliant bastard," Gansey said. "You've done it."
"What did you do?"
"Got tired of sweating is what I did. Let's look under this damn lake and get back into air conditioning."
"Oh, don't even perish."
Adam, on the other end of the boat, looked extremely unimpressed with Ronan's lack of heat tolerance.
"I didn't say anything."
"Whatever, man," Ronan replied. "I know that face. You were born in hell. You're used to it."
"Ronan," Gansey said, "Lynch." For quite a few minutes, they were all quiet as they puttered slowly through the water, watching the unspecific elements on the screen. Gansey felt the unpleasant and distinct sensation of a single drop of sweat rolling between his shoulder blades. Orla declared,
"I'm having a psychic moment."
"Pshaw," Blue replied.
"No, really." Orla opened her eyes. "Is there something on the screen now?"
There was. On the laptop screen, the images tantalized him. One was a disc of some sort, and the other was an indistinct raven. In reality, it could be any sort of bird, but for the group in this particular boat, a suggestion was all they needed.
They needed it to be a raven. It was going to be a raven. Gansey contemplated whether he could dive for the object. The first thing that occurred to him was his teal polo shirt. It would have to be removed. The next thing that occurred to him was his chinos. Could they be removed in the presence of all these females? Dubious. And finally, he considered his contact lenses. They rebelled even in pool water, and this was certainly not a swimming pool. Blue peered over the edge into the brown water. How deep is the water here? It should say, Gansey squinted at the laptop, 10 feet. Well, then? Blue flipped her sandals onto Orla's bare belly, ignoring Orla's vague protests. Gansey said, What? You can't go in. I actually can, she replied, twisting her vestigial ponytail into a tiny knot on the back of her skull. I really, really can. But, he tried, you won't be able to open your eyes in that without irritating them. Your highly cultured eyes, maybe, Blue replied. Pulling off her topmost tank top, she tossed it on top of Orla as well. Bare skin flashed through the tears in the remaining tank. My swamp eyes will be great. Gansey was stung, but before he could protest, he was forced to snatch the laptop as it toppled. Orla had suddenly and swiftly stood, sending the boat crazily off kilter. Everyone in the boat braced themselves and gazed at the bell-bottomed giantess. Stop, Blue. I'll do it, Orla ordered. Her pierced belly button was precisely at Gansey's eye level. The silver ball winked at him. It said, Watch this, boys. You're wearing clothing. I have a bikini. Blue replied ferociously, None of us can forget. If not for the sun, her voice would have iced the lake. Orla tossed her head, her magnificently large nose describing a circle in the air. Then she tore off her bell-bottom so fast that all the boys in the boat just stared at her, dazzled and stunned. Gansey couldn't understand the speed of it. One moment she was wearing clothing and the next moment she was wearing a bikini. 50% of the world was browned skin and 50% was orange nylon. From the Mona Lisa smile on Orla's lips, it was clear she was pleased to finally be allowed to demonstrate her true talents. A tiny part of Gansey's brain said, You have been staring for too long. The larger part of his brain said, Orange. Oh, for the love of God, Blue said and jumped out of the boat. Ronan began to laugh, and it was so unexpected that the spell was broken. He laughed as Chainsaw hurled herself into the air to circle where Blue had gone in, and he laughed as Orla let out a honking sound and cannonballed into the water. He laughed as the image on the laptop distorted with the rollicking water. He laughed as he stretched out his arm for Chainsaw to return to him. And then he sealed his lips with an expression that indicated he still found them all hilarious on the inside. The boat, previously stuffed to capacity, now contained only 3 boys and a small discarded pile of girls' shoes and clothing. Adam looked at Gansey, expression dazed. Is this really happening? It was really happening because the side-scan sonar showed 2 forms below the surface. One of them was nowhere near the objects and seemed to be moving in rather aimless circles. The other shot purposefully toward the vicinity of the raven, moving in brief surges that suggested a breaststroke. Gansey, former captain of the Aglenby crew team and a not untalented swimmer, approved. I feel rather ashamed, Gansey admitted. Ronan ran a hand over his shaved head. I didn't want to mess up my hair. Adam just watched the ripples spread across the water. Only a second later, Orla reemerged. Like her dive, her reappearance was dramatic. A great frothy breach that ended with her floating idly on her back, hands behind her head. It's too dark, she said, eyes closed against the sun. She seemed in no hurry to try again or get back into the boat. But it's nice and cool. Y'all should come in. Gansey had no desire to join her. He peered anxiously over the edge of the boat. 1 more second and he was going to. Blue burst up beside them. Dark hair plastered her cheeks.
With one white-knuckled hand, she clutched the edge of the boat, pulling herself half out of the water.
"Good God," Gansey said.
Blue cheerfully spit a mouthful of brown water on his boat shoes. It pooled in the canvas over his toes.
"Good God," he said.
"Now they're really boat shoes," she replied. Swinging her free arm, she tossed her prize in. It landed on the boards with a dense thud.
Chainsaw immediately leapt down from Ronan's shoulder to investigate.
"There's something else down there. I'm going back for it." Before Gansey had time to say anything to her, the murky water closed over her head. He was struck by what a glorious and fearless animal Blue Sergeant was, and he made a mental note to tell her that very thing if she didn't drown getting whatever the second thing was. She was only gone for a moment this time. The boat surged as she emerged again, gasping and triumphant. She hooked an elbow over the side. "Help me in." Adam hauled Blue in as if she were the catch of the day stretched out on the base of the boat. Although she wore much more clothing than Orla, Gansey still felt he ought to avert his eyes. Everything was wet and clinging in ways that seemed more titillating than he'd come to expect from Blue's wardrobe. Out of breath, Blue asked, "What's the first thing? Do you know?" He accepted the first object from Ronan. Yes, he knew. Gansey rubbed his fingers over the slimy surface. It was a scarred metal disc about 7 inches in diameter. There were 3 ravens embossed on it. The others must have been too buried in the silt to show on the sonar display. It was incredible that they'd seen even one of them. It would have been so easy for the disc to be completely obscured. Even easier for the identifying bird to be crusted and hidden by algae.
"Some things want to be found."
"It's a boss," Gansey said with wonder. He ran his thumb around the uneven edge of it. Everything about it spoke to age. "Or an umbo from a shield. This bit reinforced the middle of the shield. The rest of it must have rotted away. It would have been wood and leather, probably. It wasn't what he would have expected to find here, or at all. From what he could remember of his history, shields like this weren't in popular use by Glendower's time. Good armor had rendered them unnecessary. It could have been a ceremonial shield, though. Certainly the fine workmanship seemed excessive for a working piece of weaponry. And it did seem like the sort of thing that would be brought along to bury with a king. He traced the ravens. 3 ravens marked in a triangle. The coat of arms of Urien, Glendower's mythological father. Who else had touched this boss? A craftsman, his mind busy with Glendower's purpose. A soldier loading it into a boat to cross the Atlantic. Maybe even Glendower himself. His heart was on fire with it. "So it's ancient," Blue said from the other end of the boat. "Right. And what about this?" At the tone in her voice, he lifted his eyes to the large object that rested upright against the tops of her thighs. He knew what it was. He just didn't know why it was. He said, "Well, that's a wheel off the Camaro." And it was. It looked identical to the wheels currently residing on the pig, except this wheel was clearly several hundred years old. The discolored surface was pocked and lumpy. With all of the deterioration, the elegantly symmetrical wheel didn't appear that out of place beside the shield boss, if you overlooked the tattered Chevrolet logo in the middle. "Do you remember losing one a little while ago?" Ronan asked. "Like 500 years or so?" "We know the ley line messes with time," Gansey said immediately, but he felt undone. Not exactly undone, but unmoored. Released from the ruts of logic. When the rules of time became flexible, the future seemed to hold too many possibilities to bear. This wheel promised a past with the Camaro in it, a past that both hadn't happened and had. Hadn't because the keys were still in Gansey's pocket and the car was still parked back at Monmouth Manufacturing, and had because Blue held the wheel in her still damp hands.
I think you should leave these with me while you go to your mom's this weekend, Blue said, and I'll see if I can convince Calla to do her thing on them.
The boat was steered back toward shore. Orla was handed her bell-bottoms, the laptop was packed back into a bag, and the sonar device was dredged from the water. Adam wearily helped fix the boat to the trailer before climbing into the truck. Gansey was going to have to talk to him, though he didn't know what he would say. It would be good for them to get out of town together. And Ronan retreated to the BMW to drive back by himself. Probably Gansey needed to talk to him, too, though he didn't know what he would say to him, either. Blue joined him in the shade of the boat, the shield boss in her hand. This discovery was not Cabe's water, and it was not Glendower, but it was something. Gansey was getting greedy, he realized. Hungry for Glendower, and Glendower alone. These tantalizing clues used to be enough to sustain him. Now it was only the Grail he wanted. He felt grown old inside his young skin. I tire of wonders, he thought. He watched Orla's orange bikini disappear hopefully into the BMW. His mind was far away, though, still absorbed with the mystery of the ancient Camaro wheel. In a low voice, Blue asked meaningfully, seen enough? Of, oh, Orla? Yeah. The question annoyed him. It judged him, and in this case he didn't feel he'd done anything to deserve it. He was not Blue's business, not in that way. What care is it of yours, he asked, what I think of Orla? This felt dangerous for some reason. He possibly shouldn't have asked it. In retrospect, it wasn't the question itself at fault. It was the way that he'd asked it. His thoughts had been far away, and he hadn't been minding how he looked on the outside, and now, too late, he heard the dip of his own words, how the inflection seemed to contain a dare. Come on, Gansey, he thought. Don't ruin things. Blue held his gaze, unflinching. Crisp, she replied. None at all. And it was a lie. It should not have been, but it was. And Gansey, who prized honesty above nearly every other thing, knew it when he heard it. Blue Sargent cared whether or not he was interested in Orla. She cared a lot. As she whirled toward the truck with a dismissive shake of her head, he felt a dirty sort of thrill. Summer dug its way into his veins. He got into the truck. Let's go, he told the others, and he slid on his sunglasses. 25. Of course the gray man had to get rid of the two bodies. It was a nuisance, but nothing more. The sort who would break into a house for supernatural artifacts also tended to be the sort who didn't get reported missing. The gray man wouldn't be reported missing, for example. Still, he needed to wipe the bodies for fingerprints and then drive them someplace more convenient for them to die. In the trunk of the champagne abomination, the gray man had fuel cans and two Peruvian pots that were too hot to sell yet, wrapped in Dora the Explorer blankets, so he put the bodies in the back seat, buckling them so they wouldn't flop around too much. He was sadly on his way to creating an incriminating stain in yet another rental car. His father was right. Past performance really did seem to be the best indicator of future performance. While he drove, he called the Veranda Inn and Restaurant and canceled his dinner reservation. Would you like to change it to a later time? The hostess asked. The gray man liked how she said later. It was something like lighter, but with a lot more vowels. Tonight just won't work, I think. Can I reschedule for Thursday? He took the exit for the Blue Ridge Parkway. The force of the turn knocked one of the thug's heads against the window. The thug was beyond caring.
Table for one, was it?
He thought about Maura Sargent and her slender bare ankles. Make it two. He hung up the phone, put on the kinks, and drove out along the parkway. He took turn after turn until the rental car's GPS was hopelessly confused. With the rental car, he made his own path into the woods past a copse of no trespassing signs. The gray man had never regretted paying for the additional damage insurance on a rental. He parked in a small, idyllic clearing, rolled down the window, and cranked up the stereo. Pulling out missile and polo shirt, he untied their shoes. He had just put polo shirt's shoes on his own feet when his phone rang. The gray man picked it up. "Do you know who those men were?" he asked in place of a greeting. Greenmantle's voice was frenzied.
I told you there were others there.
You did, the gray man agreed. He stomped the treads of polo shirt's shoes full of good Virginia clay. Are there more?
Of course, Greenmantle said tragically.
The gray man switched to missile's shoes. The clearing was covered with their tracks. Where are they coming from?
The readings. The machines. Anyone can follow the readings, Greenmantle said. We're not the only ones with geophones lying about.
In the background, the Kinks sang about demon alcohol. How is it that you knew this thing existed again?
Same way we know anything. Rumors. Old books. Greedy old people. What is that sound?
The Kinks.
I didn't know you were a fan. In fact, it's strange to think of you listening to music at all.
Wait. I don't know why I said that. I'm sorry, that sounded terrible. The gray man was not offended. It meant that Greenmantle thought of him as a thing instead of as a person, and he was all right with that. For a moment, they both listened to the Kinks sing about port, Pernod, and tequila. Every time the gray man put on the Kinks for any length of time, he considered getting back into academia. Two of the Kinks were brothers. Fraternity in the Rock Music of the 60s and 70s would be a fine title, he thought. The Kinks intrigued him because, although they fought continuously, one member famously spitting on another before kicking over the drums and storming off stage, they remained together for decades. That, he thought, was brotherhood.
Will you be able to work around those two? Greenmantle asked. Will they be a problem?
It took the gray man a moment to realize that he was referring to missile and polo shirt.
No, the gray man said. They won't be. You're good, Greenmantle said. It's why you're the only one.
Yes, the gray man agreed. I certainly am.
Would you say that this thing is a box? No, I wouldn't say that because I don't know. Would you say that?
No, probably not.
Why did you ask then?
If it was a box, I could stop looking at things that weren't boxes.
If I thought it was a box, I would have told you to look for a box. Would I say it's a box? Why do you have to be so damn mysterious all the time? Do you get off on it? You want me thinking about boxes now? Because I am. I'll look it up. I'll see what I can do.
Hanging up, the gray man assessed the scene. In a fortunate world, the two bodies before him would lay undiscovered for years, picked at by animals and worn away by the weather. But in a world where lovebirds thought they caught a strange smell, or poachers tripped on leg bones, or buzzards inconveniently circled for days at a time, all there would be to the scene would be two men with mud-clotted shoes and defensive DNA clawed beneath their fingernails. In a way, two bodies made it easier. Made the story simpler. Two men up to no good on private property. A dispute between them. A fight that got out of hand. One for loneliness. Two for a battle. The gray man frowned and checked his watch. Hopefully these were the only bodies he'd have to bury in Henrietta. But one could never say.
26. When Blue arrived home in her soaking wet clothing, Noah was kneeling in the tiny shaded front yard of 300 Fox Way. Orla breezed right inside without saying hello to him. As a psychic, she probably saw him, but as Orla, she didn't care. Blue stopped, though. She was pleased he was there.
She rearranged the Camaro wheel under her arm and wiped damp hair off her forehead. "Hey, Noah." He was too busy being ghostly to attend to her, however. Currently, he was engaged in one of his most creepy activities, reenacting his own death. He glanced around the tiny yard as if appraising the forest glen containing only himself and his friend Barrington Welk. Then he let out a terrible mangled cry as he was struck from behind by an invisible skateboard. He made no sound when he was hit again, but his body jerked convincingly. Blue tried not to look as he bucked a few more times before falling to the ground. His head jerked, his legs bicycled. Blue took a deep, uneven breath. Though she had seen him do it 4 or 5 times now, it was always unsettling. 11 minutes. That was how long the entire homicidal portrait lasted. One boy's life destroyed in less time than it took to cook a hamburger. The last 6 minutes, the ones that took place after Noah had first fallen but before he actually died, were excruciating. Blue considered herself a fairly steadfast, sensible girl, but no matter how many times she heard his torn-up breath seizing in his throat, she felt a little teary. Between the twisted roots of the front yard, Noah's body jerked and stilled, finally dead, again. Gently, she asked, "Noah?" He was on the ground, and then, just like that, he was standing beside her. It was like a dream where the middle part was cut out, the getting from point A to point B. It was another of his creepy things. "Blue," he said, and patted her damp hair. She hugged him tightly. He was chilly against her damp clothing. She was always so worried he wouldn't snap out of it at the end. "Why do you do that?" she demanded. Noah had reverted to his normal, safe self. The only evidence of his true nature was the ever-present smudge on his cheek where the bone had been smashed in. Otherwise, he was once again slouched, mild, and eternally dressed in his Aglimby uniform. He looked vaguely bewildered and pleased to have a girl clinging to him. "That? What you did? Just now?" He shrugged, formless and amiable. "I wasn't here." "But you were, Noah," she thought. But whatever part of Noah that still existed to pour thoughts and memories into this form mercifully disappeared for the 11 minutes of his death. She wasn't sure if his amnesia over the whole thing made it more or less creepy. "Ah, Noah." He draped an arm over her shoulders, too cold and weird himself to notice that she was also damp and cold. They wandered to the door like that, a pretzel of dead boy and not psychic girl. Of course he wouldn't come in. Blue suspected he couldn't. Ghosts and psychics competed for the same power source, and in an energy showdown between Noah and Calla, there was no doubt in Blue's mind who would come out the victor. She would have asked Noah to confirm this, but he was notoriously disinterested in the details of his afterlife. Once Gansey had tersely asked, "Don't you care how it is that you're still here?" And Noah had answered with remarkable acumen, "Do you care how your kidneys work?" "You aren't going to D.C., are you?" Noah asked with some anxiety. "Nope." She'd meant to just say it with no inflection whatsoever, but in truth, she felt curiously bereft at the idea of Gansey and Adam both leaving town. She felt actually exactly like Noah sounded. Daringly, Noah offered, "I'll let you into Monmouth." Blue blushed immediately. One of her most hidden and persistent fantasies was an impossible one, living in Monmouth. She'd never really be one of the group, she thought, as long as she was living here at 300 Fox Way. She'd never really be one of them as long as she wasn't an Aglimby student, which meant she'd never really be one of them as long as she was a girl. The unfairness of it, the wanting, kept her up some nights. She couldn't believe Noah had guessed her desire so accurately. To cover her embarrassment, she huffed, "And I'd hang out all day with you and Ronan?" Gleefully, Noah said, "There's a pool table now. I'm the worst at pool ever. It's wonderful." His arm tightened around her shoulders. "Don't!" "Incoming." A man headed up the sidewalk toward them. He was carefully put together and overwhelmingly gray. At the same time that Blue appraised this gray man, she got the idea that she was also being appraised. At the end of the moment, they both eyed each other with a sort of mutual decision to not underestimate the other. "Hello," he said cordially. "I didn't mean to interrupt." First of all, the way he phrased it meant that he could see Noah, which not everyone could. Second of all, he was polite in a way that was unlike anything Blue had encountered before. Gansey was polite in a way that squashed the other party smaller. Adam was polite to reassure. And this man was polite in a keen, questioning sort of way. He was polite like tentacles were polite, testing the surface carefully, checking to see how it reacted to his presence. He was, Blue decided suddenly, very clever. Nothing to be trifled with. She gestured to her soaked clothing. "This is performance art. We're reenacting The Little Mermaid. Not the Disney version." This was her own little tentacle test. The gray man smiled agreeably. "Is he the prince? Do you stab him, or do you turn into foam at the end?" "Foam, of course," said Blue, enormously gratified. "I always thought she should have stabbed him," he mused. "I'm looking for Mora." Ah, now it all made sense. This was Mr. Gray. She'd heard his name whispered between Mora, Kala, and Persephone over the past few days, especially between Kala and Persephone. "You're the hit man." Mr. Gray had the good grace to look efficiently startled. "Oh, and you're the daughter, Blue." "The one and only." Blue fixed a penetrating gaze on him. "So, do you have a favorite weapon?" Without missing a beat, he replied, "Opportunity." Now she raised an eyebrow. "Okay. Come on. No, I'll be back out in a sec." She led the gray man inside. As always, new visitors made her over-aware of the house's unorthodox appearance. It was two houses, knitted together, and neither structure had been a palace to begin with. Narrow hallways leaned eagerly toward each other. A stray toilet gurgled constantly. The wood floors were as buckled as the sidewalk out front, as if roots threatened to come between the boards. Some of the walls were painted in vivid purples and blues, and some of them maintained wallpaper from decades before. Faded black-and-white photographs hung beside Klimt prints and old metal scissors. The entire decor was a victim of too much thrift store shopping and too many strong personalities. Oddly enough, the gray man, a serene spot of neutral color in the middle of the riot, didn't look out of place. Blue watched him watching his surroundings as they made their way into the bowels of the house. He didn't seem like the sort of person one could sneak up on. Again, she thought, don't underestimate him. "Oh," croaked Jimmy. She squeezed her ample mass past the gray man. "I'll get Mora." As Blue maneuvered him toward the kitchen, she asked, "What precisely is your intention with my mother?" "That seems very frank," Mr. Gray said. She stepped over two small girls, she wasn't certain who they belonged to, playing with tanks in the middle of the hall, and snuck past a sort of possible second cousin carrying two lit candles. The gray man lifted his arms above his head to avoid being ignited by the second cousin, who clucked at him, "Life's short." "And getting shorter every day. So you see my point. I never disputed it." Then they were in the kitchen with all its mugs and half-packaged tea and boxes of essential oils waiting to be mailed and decapitated flowers waiting to be boiled. Blue pointed to a chair beneath the fake Tiffany lamp. "Sit." "I'd rather stand." She made a neat rack of teeth at the gray man. "Sit." The gray man sat. He glanced over his shoulder, back down the hall, then back to her. He had those bright, active eyes that Dobermans and Blue Jays had. "No one's going to murder you here." She handed him a glass of water. "That's not poisoned." "Thanks." He set it down, but didn't drink it. "My only intentions right now are to ask her to dinner." Leaning her butt on the counter, Blue crossed her arms and studied him. She was thinking about her biological father, Artemis. The truth was that Blue had never met him, and in fact knew very little about him, little more than his name, Artemis. She felt strangely protective of him, though. She didn't like to think of him reappearing and finding a usurper in his place. But then again, it had been 16 years. The likelihood of him coming back was a very narrow one. And it was only dinner. "You aren't staying here, are you?" Blue asked. She meant Henrietta, not the house. She should have clarified, but he seemed to catch her meaning because he replied, "I don't stay anywhere. Not for long." "That doesn't seem very pleasant." In the background, the phone rang. Not her problem. No one was calling this house for a non-psychic. His keen expression didn't flag. "Gotta keep moving." Blue considered this wisdom before replying. "The planet spins at over 1,000 miles an hour all the time. Actually, it's going around the sun at 67,000 miles an hour, even if it wasn't spinning. So you can move plenty fast without going anywhere." Mr. Gray's mouth quirked. "That's a very philosophical loophole." After a pause, he said,
"Thing sheal juhegan, frod with frodne, bithaira firth shell ich."
It sounded like German, but from hearing Calla's whispers about the gray man, she knew it was Old English. "A dead language?" she asked with interest. She seemed to be hearing a lot of them lately. "What's it mean?"
"Meetings are held. Wise with the wise. Because their spirits are alike. Or minds. The word first has the sense of mind or spirit or soul.
It was one of the Anglo-Saxon maxims. Wisdom poetry." Blue wasn't certain that she and this gray man thought exactly alike, but she didn't think they were that different either. She could hear the pragmatic beat of his heart, and she appreciated it.
"Look, she doesn't like pork," she said. "Take her someplace they use lots of butter. And don't ever say the word chuckle around her. She hates it."
The gray man drank his water. He flicked his eyes to the hall doorway, and a moment later, Mora appeared in it, phone in one hand.
"Hi, daughter," she said warily.
For a millisecond, her expression was sharp as she analyzed whether or not Blue was in any danger from this strange man sitting at her kitchen table. She took in the glass of water in front of the gray man and Blue's casually folded arms. Only then did she relax. Blue, for her part, enjoyed the millisecond of her mother looking dangerous.
"What can I do for you, Mr. Gray?" What a strange thing this was that they all knew that Mr. Gray was certainly not Mr. Gray, and yet they all went along with it. This play-acting should have rankled Blue's sensible side, but instead it struck her as a reasonable solution. He didn't want to say who he was, and they needed to call him something. The gray man said, "Dinner."
"If you mean me cooking it for you, no," Morris said. "If we're going out, maybe. Blue, this phone's for you. It's Gansey."
Blue noticed that the gray man was abruptly not interested in who was on the phone, which was interesting because he had been so interested in absolutely everything else before.
Which Blue took to mean that really he was very interested in who might be on the phone, only he didn't want them to know he was interested, which was interesting.
"What's he want?" Blue asked.
Mora handed her the phone.
"Apparently, someone broke into his place."
27. Although both Kavinsky and Gansey were hopelessly entwined in the infrastructure of Henrietta, Ronan had always done a fine job keeping them separate in his mind. Gansey held court over the tidier, brighter elements of the town. His was a sunshiny world of Aglenby desks, junior faculty waving at his car from the sidewalk, tow truck drivers knowing his name. Even the apartment in Monmouth Manufacturing was typical Gansey, order and aesthete imposed on the ruined and abandoned. Kavinsky, on the other hand, ruled the night. He lived in the places that wouldn't even occur to Gansey. In the back parking lots of the public schools, the basements of McMansions, crouched behind the doors of public bathrooms. Kavinsky's kingdom was not so much conducted in the red-yellow-green glow of a traffic light, but in the black place just outside of the glow. Ronan preferred them separate. He did not like his foods to touch. And yet here he was, the night before Ganzi left town, taking him to one of Kavinsky's coarsest rituals. "I can do this without you," Ronan said, kneeling to pick up one of the dozens of identical fake licenses. Ganzi, pacing next to his ruined miniature Henrietta, set his eyes on Ronan. There was something intense and heedless in them. There were many versions of Ganzi, but this one had been rare since the introduction of Adam's taming presence. It was also Ronan's favorite. It was the opposite of Ganzi's most public face, which was pure control enclosed in a paper-thin wrapper of academia. But this version of Ganzi was Ganzi the boy. This was the Ganzi who bought the Camaro, the Ganzi who asked Ronan to teach him to fight, the Ganzi who contained every wild spark so that it wouldn't show up in other versions. Was it the shield beneath the lake that had unleashed it? Orla's orange bikini? The bashed-up remains of his rebuilt Henrietta and the fake IDs they'd returned to? Ronan didn't really care. All that mattered was that something had struck the match, and Ganzi was burning. They took the BMW. It would be easier to cope with a firework being inserted in its exhaust pipe than the pig's. He left Chainsaw behind, much to her irritation. Ronan didn't want her to learn any bad language. Ronan drove, since he knew where they were going. He didn't tell Ganzi why he knew where to go, and Ganzi didn't ask. The sun had gone down by the time they arrived at the old county fairground, tucked away on a back road east of Henrietta. The site had not been used to host a fair since the county fair had run out of money 2 years previous. Now it was a great overgrown field studded with floodlights and strung with tattered bunting made colorless by months of exposure. Ordinarily, the abandoned fairground was pitch black at night, out of reach of the lights of Henrietta and far from any houses. But tonight, the floodlights splashed sterile white light over the grass, illuminating the restless forms of more than a dozen cars. There was something unbearably sexy about cars at night, Ronan thought. The way the fenders twisted the light and reflected the road, the way every driver became anonymous. The sight of them knocked his heartbeat askew. As Ronan turned into the old drive, the headlights illuminated the familiar form of Kavinsky's white Mitsubishi, its black grille gaping. The trip of his pulse became a kick drum. "Don't say anything stupid to him," he told Ganzi. Already the beat of his stereo was being drowned out by Kavinsky's, the bass pulsing up through the ground itself. Ganzi rolled his sleeves up and steadied his hand as he made a fist and released it. What's stupid? It was hard to tell with Kavinsky. To their left, two cars loomed out of the darkness, one red and one white, heading right toward each other. Neither vehicle flinched from the impending collision. Automotive chicken. At the last moment, the red car swerved, skidding sideways, and the white blared a horn. A guy half hung out of the passenger seat of the white car, clinging to the roof with one hand and flipping the bird with the other. Dust wallowed around them both. Delighted screams filled the space between engine noises. On the other side of this game, a tired Volvo was parked beneath a tattered, fallen string of flagged bunting. It was lit from within like an entrance to hell. It took a moment to register that it was on fire, or at least working up to it. Boys stood around the Volvo, drinking and smoking, their forms distorted and dark against the smoldering upholstery, goblins around a bonfire. Something inside Ronan was anxious and moving, angry and restive. The fire ate him from the inside. He pulled the BMW up to the Mitsubishi, nose to nose. Now he saw that Kavinsky had already been playing. The right side of the car was shockingly mutilated and crumpled. That felt like a dream. No way was the Mitsubishi so mangled. It was immortal. Kavinsky himself stood near it, bottle in hand, shirtless, the floodlights erasing the ribs from his concave torso. When he saw the BMW, he threw the bottle at the hood. It splintered on the metal, shivering glass and liquid everywhere.
Jesus, Gansey said in either surprise or admiration. At least they hadn't brought the Camaro. Hauling up the parking brake, Ronan threw open the door. The air reeked of melting plastic and deceased clutches, and beneath it all the warm scent of pot. It was noisy, though the symphony was constructed of so many instruments that it was hard to identify any individual timbres. Ronan, Gansey said in the exact same way that he'd just invoked Jesus. Are we doing this? Ronan replied. Gansey threw open his door. Gripping the roof of the car, he slid himself out. Even that gesture, Ronan noted, was wild, Gansey. Gansey on fire. Like he pulled himself from the car because ordinary climbing out was too slow. This was going to be a night. The fire inside Ronan was what kept him alive. Catching a glimpse of Ronan heading straight for him, Kavinsky spread a hand over his flat ribcage.
Hey, lady. This is a substance party. Nobody's in unless you brought a substance.
By way of reply, Ronan clasped one hand round Kavinsky's throat and the other around his shoulder and hurled him tidily over the hood of the Mitsubishi. For punctuation, he rejoined him on the opposite side and slammed his fist into Kavinsky's nose. As Kavinsky climbed back up, Ronan showed him his bloody knuckles. Here's your substance. Kavinsky wiped his nose on his bare arm, leaving a red streak.
Hey, man, you don't have to be so fucking antisocial.
Gansey at Ronan's elbow held up his hand in the universal sign for down, boy.
I don't want to keep you from your revels, Gansey said, cold and glorious. So I'm just going to say this. Stay out of my place.
Kavinsky replied,
I don't know what you're talking about. Babe, get me a smoke.
The last part seemed to be directed to a girl who lolled in the passenger seat of the crunched Mitsubishi, her eyes deeply stoned. She did not dignify his order with a response. Ronan flicked out one of the fake IDs. Kavinsky smiled broadly at his own work. With his hollow cheeks, he was a ghoul in this light.
You mad because I didn't leave you a mint, too?
No, I'm angry because you trashed my apartment, Gansey said. You should be glad I'm here and not at the police station.
Whoa, man, Kavinsky said. Whoa, whoa. I can't tell which of us is high. Whoa, I didn't trash your place.
Please don't insult my intelligence, Gansey replied, and there was just a hint of a glacial laugh in his voice. It was a terrifying and wonderful laugh, Ronan thought, because Gansey had measured out only contempt and not a touch of humor. Their conversation was interrupted by the familiar destructive sound of cars colliding. There was nothing dramatic about the sound of newer vehicles crashing. All the safety bumpers meant it was mostly the dull thud of plastic puncturing. It wasn't the volume, though, that sent a shiver up Ronan's spine. It was the specificity of the sound. There was no other sound in the world like a car crash. Kavinsky caught the line of their attention.
Ah, he said. You want in on this, don't you?
Where are these guys from? Gansey squinted. Is that Morris? I thought he was in New Haven. Kavinsky shrugged.
It's a substance party.
Ronan growled.
They don't have substances in New Haven?
Not like these. It's Wonderland. Some make you big, some make you small.
It was the wrong quote, or rather, the right quote, done wrong. In the Lynch household, Ronan had grown up with two recurring stories, perennial favorites of his parents. Aurora Lynch's favorite had been an old black-and-white movie version of the myth Pygmalion, about a sculptor who falls in love with one of his statues. And Neil Lynch had had an extraordinary fondness for an ugly old edition of Alice in Wonderland, frequently read aloud to two or three reluctant, half-asleep Lynch brothers. Ronan had seen Pygmalion and heard Alice in Wonderland so often in his youth that he no longer could judge whether or not they were any good, whether or not he actually liked them. The movie and the novel were history now. They were his parents. So he knew the quote was actually, one side will make you grow taller, and the other side will make you grow shorter.
Depends on which side of the mushroom you use, Ronan said, more to his dead father than to Kavinsky.
True point, Kavinsky agreed. So what are you going to do about your rat problem?
Gansey blinked.
Beg pardon?
This made Kavinsky laugh uproariously, and when he was through, he said,
If I didn't trash your place, something else is infesting it.
Gansey's eyes flickered over to Ronan.
Possibility?
Of course it was a possibility. Someone other than Ronan had smashed up Declan Lynch's face, so theoretically, something other than Kavinsky could have broken into Monmouth Manufacturing.
Possibility?
Anything was possible.
Lynch!
One of the other partygoers drew closer, recognizing him. Ronan, in turn, recognized him.
Prokopenko.
His voice was milky with drugs, but Ronan would have recognized his silhouette anywhere, one shoulder crooked and higher than the other, ears like wing nuts.
And Gansey.
Yeah, Kavinsky said, thumbs hooked in his back pockets, hip bones poking out above his low-slung waistband. Mommy and Daddy came.
Hey, Gansey, do you get a babysitter for Parrish? You know what, man, don't answer that. Let's smoke a peace pipe.
Immediately, Gansey replied with precise disdain, I'm not interested in your pills.
Oh, Mr. Gansey, Kavinsky sneered. Pills? First rule of a substance party is you don't talk about substance party. Second rule is you bring a substance if you want another one.
Prokopenko chortled.
Lucky for you, Mr. Gansey,
Kavinsky continued in what was probably supposed to be a posh accent.
I know what your dog wants.
Prokopenko chortled again. It was the sort of chortle that meant he would be vomiting soon. Gansey seemed to understand this as he edged a foot back from him. Ordinarily, Gansey would have done more than edge away. Having achieved all they'd needed to, he would have told Ronan it was time to go. He would have been frostily polite to Kavinsky, and then he would have been gone. But this was not Gansey as usual. This was Gansey with a lofty tilt to his chin, a condescending quirk to his mouth, a Gansey that was aware that no matter what went down here tonight, he would still go back to Monmouth Manufacturing and rule his particular corner of the world. This was a Gansey, Ronan realized, that Adam would hate. Gansey said, And what is it my dog needs? Ronan's lips curled into a smile. Fuck the past. This was the present. Kavinsky said,
Pyrotechnics! Boom!
He pounded the roof of his crumpled car. Amiably, he told the girl in the passenger seat,
Get out, bitch! Unless you want to die. It's all the same to me.
It dawned on Ronan that Kavinsky meant to blow up the Mitsubishi. In the state of Virginia, fireworks that exploded or emitted flame higher than 12 feet were illegal unless you had a special permit. It wasn't a fact most residents of Henrietta had to remember, however, because it was impossible to find fireworks that did anything even slightly remarkable, much less illegal, within state borders. If you wanted something a bit more impressive for the holiday weekend, you headed for the city's firework display. If you were like some of the rowdier Aglenby boys or better-off rednecks of Henrietta, you drove over the state line and filled your trunk with illegal Pennsylvanian fireworks. If you were Kavinsky, you built your own.
That dent will come out, Ronan said, equal parts exhilarated and horrified to think of the Mitsubishi perishing. So many times, just the first glimpse of its taillights on the road ahead of him had been enough to pump an urgent spasm of adrenaline through him.
I'll always know it was there, Kavinsky replied carelessly. Cherry popped. Prokopenko, make me a cocktail, man.
Prokopenko was happy to oblige.
Take the edge off, Kavinsky said.
He turned to Gansey, a bottle in hand. It sloshed with liquid. A T-shirt had been wound and stuffed through the mouth of it. It was on fire. It was, in fact, a Molotov cocktail. To Ronan's surprise and delight, Gansey accepted it. He was a striking version of himself. A dangerous version of himself, standing there before Kavinsky's despoiled Mitsubishi with a homemade bomb in hand. Ronan remembered the dream of Adam in the mask, the more toothful version of Adam. Instead of throwing it at the Mitsubishi, however, Gansey sighted a line toward the distant Volvo. He hurled it, high and graceful and true.
heads curved up to watch its progress. A voice from the crowd shouted, "Whoop, whoop, Gansey boy!" which meant that at least one member of the Agma B crew team was present. A moment later, the bottle landed just short of the Volvo's rear tires. The simultaneous breaking of the glass and explosion made it seem as if the Molotov cocktail had sunk into the ground. Gansey wiped his hand on his pants and turned away.
"Good throw," Kavinsky said. "But wrong car! Proko!"
Prokopenko handed him another Molotov cocktail. This one Kavinsky pressed into Ronan's hand. He leaned close, too close, and said, "It's a bomb, just like you." Something thrilled through Ronan. It was like a dream, the sharpness of all this. The weight of the bottle in his hand, the heat from the flaming wick, the smell of this polluted pleasure. Kavinsky pointed at the Mitsubishi. "Aim high," he advised, his eyes glittered, black pits reflecting the small inferno in Ronan's grip. "And do it fast."